The Democrats become less super, the vice president becomes more criticized, and Joe Lieberman didn't become John McCain's running mate. It's time to say goodbye to the summer this week on The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. The Bernie-crats get a victory as Democrats reduce the clout of the party's superdelegates.
This is a true compromise. The Bernie supporters can feel good that they have made their point, and this provides for the attendance of the party leadership at the convention.
Plus, did Donald Trump's selection of Mike Pence as his running mate in 2016 rescue the Indiana governor from a likely defeat for re-election that year? And Joe Lieberman says there was a real chance he could have become John McCain's VP pick in 2008.
He and I rarely talked about it. He felt that what a statement this would make to America, that we're having a bipartisan ticket, but his party, and it would have been the same in the Democratic Party if the tables were turned, essentially said to him, don't do it.
It's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 243 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. We're about finished with the 2018 primary system, just a handful more states to go, and we'll have our complete lineup for the general election in November. But the narrative that existed at the beginning of the year has not changed. Control of the House and Senate is still up for grabs, with Democrats needing a net gain of 23 seats in the House to put them back in the majority. And with that would bring Nancy Pelosi back as Speaker, although that's also up for debate. And in the Senate, the number Democrats need to take control is much smaller, 3, but perhaps much more difficult to attain. There are, at this point, more Democratic seats in jeopardy than there are Republican seats. One thing complicating the Dems' chances, the upcoming vote on confirming Judge Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. At least 3, possibly 4 Democrats in solid red states are under tremendous pressure to vote yes, while liberal special interest groups are doing what they can to keep the party united in voting no. Do you live in one of these key states? Then you're probably familiar with seeing this on your TV screen.
President Trump has nominated another great judge for the Supreme Court, Brett Kavanaugh. He treats everyone fairly and has a record of applying the Constitution just as it was written. But Joe Manchin isn't being straight with West Virginians, saying his vote on Kavanaugh is about health care, a dishonest talking point he got from liberal Chuck Schumer. Tell Joe Manchin, you won't be fooled by his tricks and you won't forget how he votes on Kavanaugh.
Donald Trump just nominated Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. Here's what we already know about him. Trump said he'd only pick judges who'd reverse Roe v. Wade and outlaw abortion. And Trump made it clear his nominee would vote to overturn the Affordable Care Act, letting insurance companies charge more or refuse coverage for people with pre-existing conditions. Call your senators and tell them to oppose Trump's extreme nominee. Stop Brett Kavanaugh.
We are likely to see a vote on confirmation either way by October 1st. Meanwhile, you've got another week to answer our current trivia question, which was, who was the last senator to die in office and be replaced by his widow? If you haven't already, send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. There was a lot Bernie Sanders supporters had to complain about in 2016, perhaps nothing more than the influence inside the Democratic Party's presidential nominating system of superdelegates. They're those party luminaries, governors, senators, members of Congress, and other officials who are automatically delegates at the convention and can, and do, vote for any candidate they prefer, regardless how the vote goes in the primaries. Democrats felt it made sense to institute the system in 1984 after outsiders like George McGovern and Jimmy Carter captured the nomination. But progressives, like the ones who backed Sanders over Hillary Clinton, felt that the superdelegates were part of the establishment that was wrecking the party. At a meeting in late August, the party decided that there would still be superdelegates, but they couldn't vote until the second ballot. Elaine Kmark is a former Democratic Party insider turned senior fellow in the Governance Studies Program at the Brookings Institution. She's the author of Primary Politics, Everything You Need to Know About How America Nominates Its Presidential Candidates. Elaine, it's great having you back on the Political Junkie.
Well, thanks for having me, Ken.
Well, when one thinks back to the McGovern candidacy, which beat up the party regulars en route to the nomination in 72, only to lose 49 states to Richard Nixon in November, or even Jimmy Carter, it just seems like instituting the system of superdelegates seemed to make a lot of sense.
Well, it did at the time, but here's what actually led to it. It wasn't really outsider versus insider. It was that in 1980, we realized that under the new rules, members of Congress and governors and senators did not want to run against their constituents to be delegates to the convention. And so at a national party convention, which should consist of the national party, which includes its governors and its members of Congress, in 1980, the members of Congress were not there because, you know, they didn't want to, understandably, take a delegate slot from one of their constituents who had worked hard for them. So the party said, okay, we've got another problem here that was unanticipated by these reforms. We need to have the party leadership in attendance at the nominating convention, and so let's make them automatic delegates.
But when did it become a controversy?
It was not a controversy in 1984, 1988, 1992, 1996. 2000, 2004. In other words, for many, many years, it was not a controversy. It first became a controversy in 2008 when Barack Obama was running a very tight race against Hillary Clinton. And he brought up the issue of superdelegates, and mostly, however, as a means of wooing the superdelegates to him. And in the course of that nomination race, many people, myself included, switched from Hillary Clinton to Barack Obama. And the reason was very simple. Barack Obama was winning the majority of the primary voters, the majority of the pledged delegates. And so many of the superdelegates said, okay, we're going to be for Barack Obama. In 2012, obviously, there wasn't a nomination race in the Democratic Party. And then in 2016, the issue arose again, but this time in a slightly different form. While Hillary Clinton was winning the most delegates and the most primaries nationally, there were individual states where the state or a congressional district went for Bernie Sanders, but because of Hillary Clinton's long ties in the party, the superdelegates went for Hillary Clinton. That made a lot of people mad. It struck them as unfair. And the Sanders campaign obviously played this issue to the hilt in order to keep themselves in the game, even as they were losing in the pledged delegate count.
So even though Sanders people said it gave Hillary Clinton an unfair advantage during the battle, did it give her the nomination?
No, it did not give her the nomination. She would have had the nomination regardless of what the superdelegates had done. She would have had it without superdelegates. But here's where the Sanders people made an argument that was actually a pretty good argument. They said, look, the fact that she had such a lead among the superdelegates from the beginning influenced other people to think that she had a lock on the nomination. And they thought that that was an unfair early advantage. And so, and sure enough, from the beginning, many, many more people in Congress especially, were for Hillary than for Bernie Sanders, even though he had spent several decades in Congress himself. He was never really a full-fledged Democrat. He caucused with the Democrats, but he never called himself a Democrat. He had campaigned against some Democrats in primaries. And so he was not a favorite of his colleagues. And that meant that Hillary Clinton had an outsized advantage from the beginning among the congressional members. And the Sanders people thought that was unfair and wanted to do something about it.
And as you say, the when the media would give out their evolving delegate count, and which included the superdelegates, the Bernie-crats said that, well, it gave a skewed impression of where the race stood because of all the additional superdelegates that went for Hillary Clinton.
That's exactly right. And they had a point. You know, they had a point there. Now, the media, as the criticisms mounted, tried to separate out the two counts. You know, they would give a pledge delegate count and a superdelegate count. Hillary Clinton led in the pledge delegate count from the middle of March on, but she also led in the superdelegate count. And the argument was that this made her lead look more unsurmountable than it was.
In history, have superdelegates ever overturned the will of the people as shown during the primaries?
No, they never have. Most often, the primary has been settled before we even get to the convention and the other candidates, you know, drop out or suspend their campaigns. And in 2008, where it was pretty close, many of the superdelegates switched from Hillary to Barack Obama as it became clear that he was winning the most pledged delegates and as it became clear that he was quite an amazing political phenomenon.
Let me ask you a question. This is what almost amused me the most about this. The new rules, as I understand them, say that the superdelegates will remain, but they can't vote on the first ballot in the party's nominating process. Now, given the fact that a Democratic presidential balloting hasn't gone past a first ballot since 1952 with Adlai Stevenson, what role could these superdelegates have?
Well, the big role they have will be in the votes prior to the first ballot. There are three crucial votes before the first ballot. One is on the rules of the convention itself. Two are on the credentials challenges, if there are any. In other words, who gets seated at the convention. And three is on the platform. So the superdelegates will get to vote on all of those rules. And if the convention is settled, you know, if there's a big majority for somebody, the superdelegates will also get to vote on the first ballot. So what this does is this accomplishes in a little bit of a convoluted way, it accomplishes what the Hunt Commission sent out to accomplish, which is make sure that the party leadership is at the convention for two reasons. One is that the party leaders, these superdelegates, they have maybe the biggest stake of all in the presidential race because they're all on the ballot, particularly the members of Congress and a third of the Senate and a bunch of the governors are all on the ballot with the presidential candidate. So they obviously care who he or she is and what they stand for. And secondly, there is convention business that sets party parameters and party rules for years to come, not to mention policy for years to come. And obviously, you want the United States senators and the congressmen and the governors to be in sync with the presidential candidate on policy. Otherwise, you're not going to have much of it happen. So those are two pretty important reasons to have them there, even if they do not have a first ballot vote.
So in the scheme of things, who loses, who wins, who loses with these new rules?
Well, I think that the Bernie supporters can feel good that they have made their point and gotten a lot of the party officials to agree with them. The vote at the Democratic National Committee was 3-1 in favor of this compromise position. But I think that the institutional party, if you will, should also feel good because this provides for the attendance of the party leadership at the convention and for them to have a role in things that really matter to them. You know, nothing's worse than running for Congress or running for the Senate or running for governor and having to constantly disavow your party platform. It's embarrassing. It's awkward. Your opponent uses it against you. The people who also govern with the president also need to have a role in the party and in the parameters of that presidency. So, you know, this is, I think, a true compromise. I know we don't see much of that in Washington anymore, but this is a true compromise, painfully worked out in the last 2 years. And I think it's a pretty good one.
The people, though, who are most critical of this say that what this means with the superdelegates barred from voting for a nominee on the first ballot, that the ultimate nominee will be more left-wing than usual. Do you buy that?
I don't, because I think that a lot of that gets sorted out in the primaries themselves, you see. And so, you know, we have had a lot of Democratic primaries. We've always had left of center, middle center, you know, right of center within the Democratic Party running. And of course, they're all left of center compared to, you know, everybody else. So we've always had these divisions. And I don't think that it necessarily means that at all, especially because the superdelegates have never played a role in changing the outcome of the primaries.
Elaine K. Mark is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and the author of Primary Politics, Everything You Need to Know About How America Nominates Its Presidential Candidates. Elaine, it was great having you on the program. Actually, no, I'm sorry. It was super having you on the program.
Well, thank you. And I just want to say that the third edition of Primary Politics will be out this fall, and it includes the stories of the Trump nomination and the Hillary Clinton nomination.
Okay. We'll have you on the show again.
Okay. Thank you,
Elaine,
so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
It was one of the first key decisions presidential candidate Al Gore made, and it was, shall we say, a bit unorthodox.
With pride in his achievements, with gratitude for his acceptance of this challenge, and with faith in his fight for working families, I'm here to announce my running mate, the next Vice President of the United States, Senator Joseph Lieberman of Connecticut.
In an era where a presidential running mate has often been seen as a hardcore partisan, the selection of Joe Lieberman was different. The first Jew ever to be part of a national ticket, Lieberman had the reputation as a fighter for bipartisanship, even if it meant taking on his own party at times. A two-term senator from Connecticut, he had friends on both sides of the aisle. He famously and publicly attacked President Bill Clinton for his behavior during the Monica Lewinsky scandal. But at the same time, he was a solid Democratic vote when it came to climate change, abortion, women's rights, civil liberties, and labor issues. It was 18 years ago this week at the Democratic Convention in Los Angeles when Joe Lieberman made it official.
Tonight, I am so proud to stand as your candidate for Vice President of the United States. Thank you, dear friends. I am humbled by this nomination and so grateful to Al Gore for choosing me. And I want you to know tonight that I will work my heart out to make Al Gore the next president of the United States.
Joe Lieberman has gone through quite a lot since then. The Gore-Lieberman ticket lost in November, even though it received more votes than the Republican opposition. 6 years later, Lieberman was defeated in the 2006 Democratic primary in Connecticut in his bid for a fourth Senate term. But he won re-election by running on an independent third-party ticket. And he was almost, maybe, John McCain's running mate in 2008. We'll find out in a minute. Joe Lieberman, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Thanks, Ken. Great to be with you. I must admit, hearing some of those voices from yesteryear was quite thrilling to me.
Well, you've gone from Democratic State Senate Majority Leader in Connecticut to State Attorney General to U.S. Senator to candidate for Vice President to Independent Senator to almost Republican candidate for Vice President. More than 40 years in public office. It's been, shall we say, an unconventional career?
Yeah, I guess it has as I look back to it. And I didn't intend it that way. I mean, part of what I did is just called every issue, every campaign as I saw it, as I thought was best. Sometimes that put me, most of the time it put me with my Democratic Party, but sometimes it didn't. And in a time of our politics, which became increasingly partisan and ideologically divided, I became, much to my surprise, the odd man out. But I look back at it, and I honestly don't regret any of that, because I feel that I did what I believed was right and best for our country at the time.
Well, the first time I met you, we were sitting next to each other on an Amtrak train going from Washington to New York. I think it was 1989, and for some congressional event related to the Constitution, you had just defeated Lowell Weicker for the Senate, and conservatives hated Weicker. I mean, William F. Buckley and the Buckley family supported you over Weicker.
Yeah.
Did that amuse you in some ways?
It did. I mean, just personal story. Bill Buckley was about 10 or 12 years older than I. But he took a real interest in the Yale Daily News, where he was editor, and I was editor. And so we got to be friends. And I would go to his house in Stamford about once a year to have dinner. And great conversation, but never thought that he would endorse me. But you're right. He really despised Lowell Weicker. He called me up one day, and he said, I wish I could impersonate that great voice. Joe, I'm thinking of endorsing you. Do you think it would help? And I said, you know, I think it might, with Republicans are thinking about voting for me. But don't get me wrong, he said. This is the only time. So he was a lot of fun and a great thinker, had a big effect on our politics.
Okay, let me go back to move up to 2000. There was so much analysis, so much psychobabble as to why Al Gore chose you as his running mate.
Yes.
And I think, what was going to become the post-Bill Clinton era, you represented morals, decency, and values, and in some ways you were portrayed as the anti-Clinton. Do you agree with that analysis?
There may have been some of that, although the fault in it is that I was one of the earliest supporters of Bill Clinton, because I believed in his vision of a new Democratic Party. And though I made that speech critical of his behavior with Monica Lewinsky, I voted against convicting him for impeachment because I thought the Constitution never contemplated that a person would be pushed out of office for behavior like that, particularly since he was receiving favorable support from on his general performance from more than 60% of the people. But, okay, I think maybe that was part of what was in Al Gore's mind, that I was a kind of response or even antidote to Bill Clinton. But there was something more, that Bill Clinton and Al Gore and I had been part of the New Democratic Movement. I think we understood and shared beliefs about how the Democratic Party had to be not a left party, but a center-left party, and one that was open to a lot of different kinds of people. And we got to know each other, Al Gore and I, and I think at some very personal level, he knew he could trust me. I sure hope so. We were friends and still are.
Did you get any sense at the time that Gore was pulled in different directions as to how to deal with Clinton and his faults?
Yeah, I mean, I think I heard some of it, but really I heard some more of it from other people. That is, I could feel some of it in Al, but I think he felt that the Lewinsky scandal hung over his head as he went into the campaign. I'm sure it didn't help, but the fact is that the Clinton-Gore administration had a tremendous record of accomplishment. I mean, I could almost recite my campaign speeches from that year. We had 22 million jobs created, and the government, believe it or not, was in surplus when Bill Clinton and Al Gore left office. So there was really a record to run on, and it's what made the election so very, very close, even though, as you know, history says that when you run as the candidate of the party that's been in for two terms as president, the odds are that you're not going to win.
The Gore-Lieberman team was the first Al and Joe ticket since 1928, when Al Smith became the first Catholic nominated for president. In 2000, the Al and Joe team included the first Jew on a major ticket. That was a major point of pride for you, wasn't it?
It was a major point of pride for me, and really a major point of gratitude from me toward Al Gore, because the choice that the presidential candidate makes of the running mate is one of the most unilateral choices in American politics. I mean, generally speaking, the convention is going to accept what the presidential nominee wants. And he had the confidence in the American people to believe that they would not vote for me or against me because of my religion. And he was right. I mean, the fact is that the first ticket, major party ticket, on which there was a Jewish candidate, happened to be myself, did get 544,000 more votes than the Republican ticket. Now, I don't say that to relitigate the hanging chads in Florida, but simply to say what a great, fair, open, accepting people the American people are. And, of course, they proved it again in 2008 with Barack Obama.
Well, one of my favorite moments listening to the event in Nashville when Al Gore announced you as his running mate was this introduction.
Ladies and gentlemen, the next president of the United States of America, Al Gore and Tipper Gore. And the next vice president of the United States, Joe Lieberman and Hadassah Lieberman.
Hadassah Lieberman.
Yeah.
I don't think it's a name he's ever heard before.
I'll tell you, Hadassah developed a method for telling people, because it was an unusual name. She said, here's what you should think. Que pasa Hadassah. I'll tell you a quick story, because this Hadassah is the child of two survivors of the Holocaust who met in Prague after the war, got married, and she was born there. And then when the communists came into control in Czechoslovakia, my father-in-law decided it was time to leave, and he came to America, thank God. Hadassah went through her life with nobody being able to say her name. And during the campaign in 2000, people learned how to say Hadassah. And afterward, we were at a Dunkin' Donut out in Silver Spring, Maryland. I can remember it, waiting for our daughter who was at basketball practice. And a police officer comes in and says, Senator Lieberman, great to see you. And then he turns to her and says, and Hadassah, what a pleasure to meet you. And he turns away, and she's crying. I said, what in God's name are you crying about? She said, that man knew how to pronounce my name. And my whole life, nobody could do it. So that's America. I tell you a story in terms of being the first Jew on a national ticket, which is really a lesson. The night that I flew to Nashville before the morning that Al was going to announce my selection, he was gracious enough to invite my family to dinner with his family. And he said that he had decided about 3 weeks before that I was his choice for vice president, but he felt that he had a responsibility to talk to some close friends and advisors and ask them whether they thought America was ready for a Jewish vice president, the proverbial heartbeat away from the presidency. And he said the responses were really quite interesting. He said, I talked to some Jewish friends, and among them there was great anxiety and uncertainty about me selecting you, Joe. Then I spoke to a bunch of Christian friends, and every one of them said, no problem, Al. So Al's joke was, because I know there are so many millions more Christians in America than Jews, I was able to select you as my running mate. But of course, the story there is that the Jewish reaction to the possibility of me being on the ticket was based on Jewish history and anxiety about whether the country was ready. The Christian reaction, which was so positive, was an expression of the fact that the country was ready. And, of course, on Election Day, we found out, at least in terms of the popular vote, that it was.
Well, that's interesting. You remember when Barack Obama was first running, there were many African-Americans who said it's not his time or it's not a time for an African-American president, and they were scared on many accounts.
Again, it's the result of history. It's understandable, but it takes somebody like Al Gore, who had the confidence to break a barrier, and then somebody like Barack Obama, who had the self-confidence to do it, to bring about progress, to challenge the American people. And generally speaking, when they are challenged to do the right thing, they do.
Back to Hadassah Lieberman. I know she was very active with women's health issues. How is she?
Hadassah is great. She, like I, are enjoying this chapter of our lives. We followed the migratory flight pattern of grandparents and have settled in Riverdale, New York, where we found the greatest concentration of children and grandchildren. We have one son in Atlanta with two children, a daughter in Baltimore with four kids. We've got two up here with a total of five grandchildren. So we're very happy she is too. And you know, we just consider ourselves blessed. We've had a great life. 2000 didn't work out as we hoped it would. The whole campaign was just an extraordinarily positive experience until election night, and then less positive. But life since then has been great. I would say that I probably had my most productive years in the Senate after 2000. And now this new chapter, practicing law, teaching, working on a lot of nonprofit boards, and more time with the family has really been great.
And you're also on the Political Junkie program.
And to be on the Political Junkie program, perhaps the ultimate accomplishment.
That was the correct answer, Senator.
Yes.
I remember going back to that convention in Los Angeles, I remember one delegate telling me that she couldn't wait for the debates, the Gore debate against George W. Bush. Do you think the Democrats underestimated Bush?
Probably, although I think Al did generally well, very well in the debates. But, you know, people do benefit from low expectations. And that was probably true of George W. Bush in those debates. Now, people who said he wasn't smart never convinced me because, you know, I went to Yale and George W. Bush went to Yale, and I just figured that meant he was automatically smart.
It was a self-compliment there, wasn't there?
Yeah.
You know, I once asked Michael Dukakis what he would have done differently in 1988, and he said he would have responded much quicker to the negative attack ads put out by the Republicans. Is there something you or your ticket should have done differently? I mean, other than win Florida or Tennessee or something like that.
Yeah, that's really interesting. It's really interesting to hear Mike Dukakis's response to you, because that's the year I was running for senator, and I remember him coming in and telling me people were sick of the back and forth of negative ads, and just if they're negative on you, just let it be, which of course I didn't do. You know, I think other than, and I disagreed with the campaign decision not to use Bill Clinton in some states. I mean, they told me the polls showed that certain demographic groups went down in their support of Al Gore and me when Clinton came in. But, you know, in places like Tennessee and Arkansas, I think if we had just let him go, he's such an extraordinary political figure, a great advocate, and he was a great advocate for our ticket. Who knows what might have happened? Wouldn't have taken much, Tennessee, Arkansas, or New Hampshire, and that would have been it.
You know, I mean, we talk about the 537 votes in Florida or the 5-4 decision on the Supreme Court, but do you have those what if moments? Do you think about that much? Like what would have been different in the country had Gore Lieberman?
Oh, I mean, afterward, oh, I do. I mean, I have by my nature, Ken, I go on. You know, I mean, when the day after we conceded, it was December by then, but the Senate, believe it or not, was still in session, and you'll never guess why. There was a budget crisis, so. But the first thing I did the next morning was to go to work. But as time went on, people would ask me the what-if question, and I thought about it. And I think things would have been a lot different. I mean, my guess is that after 9/11, Al Gore, as commander-in-chief, would have ordered our troops into Afghanistan to wipe out the Taliban for harboring Al-Qaeda. I doubt that we would have gone into Iraq. There wouldn't have been the enormous and I think unfair tax cut that was adopted in the early months of 2001 that began to put our government into debt. And of course, we would have done a lot more about climate change, which is a really serious to critical problem now that nothing has happened about. So, yeah, I think you can't look back and say, oh, everything would have been wonderful if only Al Gore and I had been elected. But it would have been different in those significant ways that I've just described.
How close did you come to becoming John McCain's running mate in 2008?
I must say closer than I ever expected. And when they first told me, Rick Davis, the campaign manager, that John wanted to consider me for vice president. Honestly, my reaction was, are you kidding? So he said, no, I'm not kidding. He's serious. So I said, would you please tell him he doesn't have to do this to thank me for supporting him. I'm supporting him because he's my friend. I think he's the best and he can do this job. No, he's serious about it. And I think John did feel that the Republican Party was down in 2008, and Barack Obama was beginning to sort of walk on the clouds, you know. And he had to do something different, and one way to show that he was different was to have a Democratic running mate. But I just couldn't see, as the politics was getting so divided, how he could do it. But he and I rarely talked about it. Lindsey Graham, our third amigo, declared himself my campaign manager within the campaign. And he would periodically tell me, we got this one. Well, I'm not sure about that one. But in the end, I think they convinced John that choosing me would divide the Republican Party and it would make the convention awful messy. And but it really, I think he clung to it, the idea, because we're friends and we agree on so much. We disagree on things also. But I think he felt that what a statement this would make to America, that we're having a bipartisan ticket, but his party, and it would have been the same in the Democratic Party if the tables were turned, essentially said to him, don't do it. So he did something else that he thought was different. He needed a Hail Mary, and he went for Sarah Palin.
Hail Sarah.
Hail Sarah, right.
Joe Lieberman is a former four-term senator from Connecticut who was the Democratic Party's candidate for vice president in 2000. He's currently the senior counsel at Kasowitz Benson Torres, LLP. Senator Lieberman, it was wonderful having you on the program.
Great to be with you, Ken. Thanks for your love of politics and public service, which comes through everything you do.
And thank you. And come by and visit sometime, and you'll see the most amazing Lieberman button collection you've ever seen in your life.
I would like that. Take care.
Thank you. It was 18 years ago last month, on August 16th, 2000, that Joe Lieberman, the senator from Connecticut, accepted the Democratic nomination for vice president, the first person of the Jewish faith to appear on a major party national ticket.
Isn't life strange? A turn of the page. Can read like before. Can we ask for more?
He was a little-known Midwestern governor in danger of losing his bid for re-election until this happened.
So I'm here today to introduce the man who will be my partner in this campaign and the White House to fix our rigged system. We are in a rigged system. And to make America safe again and to make America great again. With that, I would like to introduce a man who I truly believe will be outstanding in every way and will be the next Vice President of the United States, Governor Mike Pence. Thank you. Thank you, everybody. Thank you.
Mike Pence of Indiana. He was elected to Congress in 2000 on his third try and served six terms. And he was narrowly elected governor of Indiana in 2012 by just 3 percentage points. Just falling short of getting a majority of the vote over Democrat John Gregg. The two were locked in a close rematch in 2016 until Trump came calling. As governor, as he was in Congress, Pence was seen as a strong social conservative, a favorite of the religious right. In selecting him, Trump solidified his standing with these Christian conservatives, who never fully trusted him. And as vice president, Pence has been steadfastly loyal to the man who picked him. A new book on Pence is out, an investigative biography that is quite critical, well-documented, and judged by many reviewers as quite fair. It's called The Shadow President, The Truth About Mike Pence, by Michael D'Antonio and Peter Eisner. Michael is also the author of The Truth About Trump and a CNN contributor, and he joins us now to talk about his book. Michael, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Great to be with you, Ken.
Well, you know, the shadow president, it sounds almost sinister, as if Mike Pence is holding a vast amount of power behind the scenes, waiting his turn, the man behind the throne. Is that the case?
Well, to some degree, yes. He is the man behind the scenes waiting to take his place. That's for certain. Pence began imagining himself president when he was in high school. By the time he was in college, he was telling people that he believed God intended him to be president. And every move he's made in his life from that point forward was intended to bring him closer to the Oval Office. And when you look at who populated the administration, it wasn't Donald Trump who had the connections to the Republican establishment and people who could fill these positions in the bureaucracy. It was Mike Pence. And even when you get to matters of district court justices, judges, and appeals court judges, Pence is the guy providing the energy behind a lot of those nominations. So we think of him as both a fellow waiting in the shadows to take over, but also a person who wields much more power than people understand and is much more engaged in pushing the president's agenda and his own agenda than folks realize.
Well, you know, you mentioned that the aw shucks kind of guy that that Mike Pence has tried to portray himself up. I think of his VP debate with Tim Kaine in 2016. I want to play a little bit of that debate where he comes across as just a regular, you know, homespun guy.
I have to tell you, I'm a small town boy from a place not too different from Farmville. I grew up with a cornfield in my backyard. My grandfather had immigrated to this country when he was about my son's age. My mom and dad built everything that matters in a small town in southern Indiana. They built a family and a good name and a business, and they raised a family. And I dreamed someday of representing my hometown in Washington, D.C., but I honestly, Elaine, I never imagined I'd have the opportunity to be governor of the state that I love, let alone be sitting at a table like this.
Michael, that's not the Mike Pence you write about in your book.
This humility that he expresses is part of his crafted persona. He uses the words I'm humbled over and over again. And it is, you know, a technique. When he describes his parents building a business, well, his father joined a company that he eventually got part ownership of, and it was 200 convenience stores and gas stations. He says, I worked in my dad's gas station. Well, it sounds like he was operating a shop down on the corner when, in fact, it was such a huge business. It was a $300 million a year business, and it went bankrupt. That's a thing that he has in common with Trump. He was a major stockholder, and it went bankrupt in 2005, leaving creditors holding the bag for $100 million. And the people in the state of Indiana had to pay $20 million to clean up the pollution they left behind.
When I think of him as governor, though, what I think of the most is his promotion of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Tell me or explain what that was and what happened to it.
This was the most controversial moment of Mike Pence's political career. The Indiana legislature, at his behest, passed a very sweeping bit of law that would allow private businesses to discriminate on almost any basis. But the main intent was to discriminate against customers on the basis of sexual preference. So it's the opposite of court cases that said, well, you can't discriminate just because someone comes in and they're gay. He wanted shopkeepers and service providers to just discriminate and declare it a religious concern that they couldn't serve a gay couple because they were opposed to homosexuality. And this blew up in his face. The moment it was adopted, he had a secret signing ceremony. And if you look at the photo, it almost looks like the Last Supper, Da Vinci's Last Supper, because it's Pence in the middle, and flanking him are all these people in religious garb. That signing photo got out. Someone leaked it. It was in the paper, and the next day, the Indianapolis Star had a huge headline saying, "Fix this." And it was because the public response to Indiana essentially embracing discrimination was vehement and nationwide. People said they were going to cancel conventions and no longer send sports teams to Indiana because of this.
Right. I was going to say also a big business boycott as well.
Well, yes. Angie's List, the famous home advising company, actually the CEO organized all kinds of executives, people from Eli Lilly, which is a major company in Indiana, and Cummins Engine, and they all demanded that Pence retreat. And after a disastrous interview with George Stephanopoulos on ABC, he did retreat and asked the legislature to change the bill, and they did, and that kind of discrimination remained illegal.
Well, in that sense, he's different than President Trump, because he admitted a mistake and he worked to rectify it. No, you don't agree?
Yeah, that's a great observation. And I think there was another time when he admitted a mistake, and that was after his second campaign for Congress, which he lost. He lost twice. He declared that he had been a negative campaigner.
1990, yeah.
And that this was a big mistake. And he apologized publicly for what he did. And that's not something you'd ever see Donald Trump do.
We were talking about, we both agree that religious act was the most memorable thing about his governorship. What I think, what comes to mind most as vice president, is the time when he flew to Indianapolis for the football game between the Colts and the San Francisco 49ers. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, this was at the start of the controversy over players either kneeling or otherwise protesting during the national anthem to call attention to disparities in law enforcement and issues like the rate of imprisonment for black men and the shootings by police of black suspects. And the whole idea was to have Pence go, stand for the national anthem, and then depart in a huff because some of the players knelt.
As we knew they would.
Because they would, of course. And it was political theater. He did it in service to Donald Trump. It costs the taxpayers mightily, both locally and nationally. We had to send him there on Air Force Two, and the local police departments had to provide extra security. And it was just a display, just a way of calling attention to a sore point for many Americans and a divisive issue.
George Will is hardly a liberal, but George Will said this in a column entitled, "Trump is no longer the worst person in government." He said Pence, quote, "with his talent for toadyism and appetite for obsequiousness, has become America's most repulsive public figure." He said, "Trump is what he is, a floundering, inarticulate jumble of gnawing insecurities and not at all compensating vanities, which is pathetic. Pence is what he has chosen to be, which is horrifying." What do you make of that? That's pretty strong stuff.
It is strong stuff. And I think it is something that a lot of mainstream Republicans who don't speak up nevertheless feel. And this is the strange moment we now live in, that you can't even say something obvious. And in this case, it's that Mike Pence has abandoned many of his principles in service to his ambition in order to be this toady vice president. And, you know, all vice presidents do serve the president they join at in Washington, but they don't all do it with the level of obsequiousness and lack of dignity that Pence seems to demonstrate. There was that moment in the cabinet room in December 2017 where Trump went around the table asking people to praise him. And Pence's contribution to this crazy exercise lasted 3 minutes, and every 14 seconds he said something in praise of the president, and at the end described the great honor and blessing he enjoyed as vice president to this man in the Oval Office. So I think he's taken the role of second fiddle to a new low in service to Donald Trump.
You know, we've talked about some, there are Republicans who are not pleased with Pence's actions, but there's also been a big debate on the left about the wisdom of impeaching President Trump. But first of all, we should state for the record that the total number of presidents impeached and removed from office in history is zero. But putting that aside, I've heard a lot of people on the left say they're nervous about the prospect of impeaching Trump because then you get Mike Pence.
I agree with them.
Well, I was going to say, if you had a choice, who would you want in the Oval Office?
At this moment, I think I'd prefer Donald Trump. Everyone knows what they're dealing with when it comes to Trump. He has achieved, with his tax cut, his major domestic objective. He's disruptive in terrible ways, but the world has kind of adjusted, and there's like a Trump discount that's now in place where what he says is discounted significantly by everyone else. With Pence, there's an uncertain quality to him. We don't know quite what he would do, but I think he'd be more effective. He would be devoted to rolling back marriage equality, to destroying the rights to abortion that people now have. And I think he'd be far more aggressive when it comes to funneling public dollars to religious schools. So his entire agenda is Trump's and then some, and he'd be better at pursuing it.
You don't have any doubt that he's planning to run in 2024 or in 2020 should Donald Trump not be a candidate?
I have no doubt. The people around Pence say Mike will be ready when the moment comes to be president, and they imagine it could happen any moment now. You know, if he, starting in January, gets somehow into the Oval Office because Trump is either resigns or is forced out, we could have President Pence for 10 years. And I think that would suit him quite well. And whether Trump runs again in 2020 or decides he's had enough, we'll see a Pence for President campaign.
And that could lead to another Michael D'Antonio book.
You know, I'm hoping there'll be someone else, maybe of a different party, to examine. I think between Trump and Mike Pence, I've done my bit.
Michael D'Antonio is the co-author of the new book, The Shadow President, The Truth About Mike Pence. Michael, thank you so much for being on the show.
My pleasure, Ken. Now I'm a believer, not a trace of doubt in my mind. I've been alone. Now I'm a believer, I couldn't leave her if I tried.
That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken@krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week. Then I saw her face. Now I'm